Okay, good evening. I think we have just about everyone out in from the lobby area. I'd like to welcome everyone here tonight for this meeting between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the community. The purpose of tonight's meeting is for the NRC staff to take comments and questions from members of the audience, and we'll address those questions as we can. In addition, I'd like to point out that this meeting tonight is being videotaped by AGP Video, and this will be shown on the local government channel, as I understand it, in San Luis Obispo. With that, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Bill Jones. I'm with the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I'm a branch chief in our Region 4 office with responsibility for overseeing the inspection activities at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. With that, I'd like to introduce the staff that we have here tonight to take questions and comments from members of the public. I'll start with Dr. Bruce Mallett, the regional administrator in Region 4, Mr. Tony Vagel, the deputy division director in Division of Reactor Projects, Mr. Barry Westrich, a branch chief with the Reactor Security Oversight Branch in headquarters, Mr. Jeff Laughlin, emergency preparedness specialist, Mr. Ray Keller out of our Region 4 office in Region 4. He is an independent spent fuel storage installation inspector, and he is involved directly with the inspection activities ongoing at the Diablo Canyon plant involving the ISFC installation. To my left is Mr. Terry Jackson, the senior resident inspector at Diablo Canyon. Mr. Jackson is a member of this community, and he has principal responsibility for implementing our inspection program at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. Along with him is Mr. Tim McConnell in the audience. He is the resident inspector, shares those same responsibilities. Now, these two individuals are the ones who, as I indicated, conduct our baseline inspections at the Diablo Canyon plant on a day-to-day basis, are a member of your community, and those are the individuals who would respond to any events or conditions that may occur out at the plant. In addition, I would like to introduce Mr. Tony Brown. Mr. Brown is currently a reactor inspector, but will be joining the resident inspector staff at Diablo Canyon here in San Luis Obispo in the near future. Mr. Brown will also be helping to facilitate the questions and comments from the audience tonight, and he will be providing some ground rules for those discussions in a short bit. In addition, we have Mr. Victor Drix from our Public Affairs Office. Mr. Drix is in the audience, and he may be out with the media right now, but he's an individual that you can contact through our website at nrc.gov for any questions. We can address your comments. We have put together a diverse group of individuals to cover what we believe are many of the areas that are of concern and areas that we think that we will have questions and comments from the public. Tonight's meeting is our second meeting here in San Luis Obispo today. Earlier at 2:30, we had a meeting between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Pacific Gas and Electric involving the performance at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. The purpose of that meeting was to discuss last year's performance. Just to briefly summarize, the NRC did find that the Diablo Canyon Power Plant was operated in a safe manner, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will be implementing the baseline inspection program during this subsequent year. At this point, I would like to introduce Dr. Bruce Mallett, our regional administrator, for a few opening comments.
Good evening. I appreciate everyone coming out for this meeting. We've been involved now since about the year 2003 and on public meetings with you all, and we've learned and benefited a lot from those meetings. I know you haven't always agreed with the answers that we give, but I can tell you that we benefit enormously from the questions you ask and from the issues and concerns that you raise with us. It's very important for us to hear those and to have that interchange. We've tried different things during those meetings. One of them that you suggested a long time ago was have them in the evening so more people can come, and that's why we're having this one at 6:30 this evening. Another issue you raised with us in the past was to have more question and answer time or more time for you to make statements or concerns that you'd like to raise with us. So we've not prepared any agenda tonight as far as any briefings or anything for that. We simply want to give you some time so that we don't have to go into the late hours of the evening before you get a chance to ask your question. I wanted to raise a couple things first. Since the last time, I was not able to be here last December during the meeting, but I watched the entire video of the meeting, and there were a lot of good issues, a lot of good dialogue in that meeting. But there were a few questions that you asked that we didn't have sufficient information at the time to answer. So I want to take a few minutes to give you some information as to what has occurred since that time in those areas. It might help you understand where we are. One of those was, as I mentioned earlier, that you wanted more time for question and answer. So we're going to do that this evening. So that's the first feedback. Another was, what's the status of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals? And as you all know, they made a June 2nd decision that requested the NRC to review that decision, whether or not we should consider terrorism and the impacts of that during environmental assessments of dry storage facilities like the one at Diablo Canyon. Because that is in litigation, we can't discuss a lot of details about that, but I can tell you we are in a process of evaluating that decision and what our next actions are. And I anticipate our commission will make a decision on that. We have asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for time to respond. They have given us to August 31 to make that decision. And our commission is evaluating that, and we're in the process of coming up with an answer. There's a lot of questions about when that might occur. I can't give you a definite time frame on that, but I can tell you this, that the schedule for that facility, according to the licensee, is they will not be ready to load fuel in there until at least a year from now. And our commission will certainly make a decision before that point in time on this petition. I will say that we have not halted construction of this dry storage facility at Diablo Canyon at this point. What we are doing is assuring that as it's being built, that it meets the standards and requirements necessary for the safe operation of that facility. We brought Mr. Ray Keller here. He's probably one of the most renowned experts in this area. He's been out here many times and inspected various parts of the construction of the facility. We have a model over here of the facility. If anyone wants to have some information on that, we'd be glad to discuss it with you. I and many others here have been out to the site. I went out yesterday. Many people here with me at the table went out today. We looked at the facility. At this point in time, as you know, the license allows them to construct 7 concrete areas for storage of fuel in a dry state. They've constructed one of those areas and completed the pouring of the concrete for that. They plan to construct and pour the concrete for the second area sometime in August. So that's where they are currently. Another area I wanted to get back to you on was a lot of questions the last time were in the area of security and what have we done to assure security for a dry storage facility as well as the nuclear power plant. And we have, as we indicated last December, taken steps in 3 areas to improve security at the facility. Those areas are in prevention of things to occur, mitigation if they do occur, and emergency response if they do occur. We cannot discuss the details of the actions we have, but we have Mr. Barry Westrich here to my right, who is here to answer questions and tell you, we can tell you in general terms what we have done. And I thought if, Barry, you could take a few minutes and tell them what's on our website to explain for them what we've done in this area would be helpful.
Yeah, we've taken a lot of steps, some extensive steps in all areas of physical security. And on our website, There's some frequently asked questions you can go to. If you go to our website at www.nrc.gov and go to security, you can see that there's areas where we talk about physical security, some of the orders we've issued. There's orders in a number of areas for power reactors. And also recently we've started issuing inspection reports and putting in inspection report cover letters available to the public. I don't think they're on that website, but you can do a search in our ADAMS, which is our document management system, and do a search for Diablo Canyon inspection reports and security, and all the inspection report cover letters have started to be placed on there. And that's a recent change. The commission's looking to be a little bit more open with security. It doesn't give a lot of information, but it is a start to give you some information. Also recently, there's a
description of what we often call three phases to our review of on-site security. And it's not the most exciting reading, but it's helpful to look at what we've been doing in those areas in those phases. Those are almost done in the areas of prevention and mitigation, emergency response for on-site. We are conducting, in accordance with Department of Homeland Security, just starting this week, what we call a comprehensive review of the off-site security at the facility or around the Diablo Canyon site. And Jeff Laughlin is here, and he's on that review team, and I thought he could take just a minute or two to explain what that comprehensive review is and what we're doing.
Yeah, the comprehensive review is a presidentially mandated, essentially a vulnerability analysis of the critical infrastructure and key resources for critical facilities around the country, things like nuclear plants, chemical plants. And the comp reviews are starting with all nuclear plants. I think Diablo Canyon is like the 65th plant now that's been evaluated. The goal is to reduce exposure to terrorism by developing plans to protect the critical infrastructure and the key resources around the nuclear plant. It's not an inspection. It's an information gathering process on the off-site infrastructure to identify potential gaps, we call them, in resources. And then the outcome is an integrated protective measures analysis is produced in a document, and that delineates the current protection resources and capabilities that are available in the off-site area around the plant. And it also describes these potential gaps in equipment and training that might be necessary to provide so that additional resources are available. And it also describes potential enhancements that can be made to the off-site infrastructure. So it's a federal team that comes in. We have a Coast Guard representative. We have a FBI representative, Department of Homeland Security, NRC. We also bring in some bomb squad experts, those kind of people, that could provide some information on potential terrorism-type scenarios. And we as a team do that during this week. We'll finish on Thursday and then go back and do our write-up. So that's a brief overview.
Now, you might ask, why am I telling you this, or did I feel necessary to tell you this? During the last meeting, as I said, we had in December, there were a lot of questions about what are we doing. I wanted to let you know that we had in the past focused on prevention, so you didn't have things occur. These reviews have focused on, well, what if something does occur, such as an aircraft hitting the facility or does decide to do that? What can be done to mitigate that circumstance or to improve the mitigation of that circumstance? And that's what these things are focusing on. And I think these phases will all be done and licensees will have implemented things sometime in the 2006 timeframe, is my understanding, son. The three phases, right?
Yeah, the three phases complete in phase two and three are very close as well. So probably by the end of 06 or early 07.
Thank you, Barry. With that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Jones.
Okay. Thank you. We'd like to introduce Mr. Victor Drix. He just came in. He is our public affairs officer out of the Region 4 office. Also, just as an administrative item, we do plan to conduct this meeting until approximately 9 o'clock, and we'll evaluate at that time to finish up the questions. We also have provided feedback forms for your review, and we would appreciate any comments that you have regarding this meeting. In addition, you may have noticed there were several handouts available outside the room, including the handouts that were used during the 2:30 discussion on the performance review of Diablo Canyon. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Tony Brown, who will be facilitating the questions and comments from the audience, and he will provide a few ground rules for conduct of that. Tony?
Thanks, Bill. Good evening and welcome. As Bill said, my name is Tony Brown. As a facilitator, my responsibility this evening is to make sure that everyone who wants an opportunity to speak has that opportunity. Just a few ground rules. The expectation is that this meeting will be conducted in a professional and orderly manner. If you would like to speak, please just raise your hand. I'll come to you and bring the microphone. I ask that you keep your comments and questions to 3 to 5 minutes. This will support our goal of allowing as many people as possible to participate. Although we're not making a transcript of tonight's comments, the meeting is being videotaped. I ask that you please state your name and affiliation, if appropriate, prior to making your comments and asking questions. I ask that only one person speak at a time. This will ensure that we all provide our full attention to whoever has the floor at the time. We'll plan on taking a short break after about an hour. As Bill said, our expectation is that this meeting will conclude around 9 o'clock. If we don't get to everyone's questions tonight, or if you would like additional contact with the NRC, please feel free to contact our public affairs officer, Victor Drix, at 800-952-9677. Once again, that's 800-952-9677. His email is vld@nrc.gov. Again, that's vld@nrc.gov. With that, let's begin the discussion. Any questions?
Ready for that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. My name is Marilyn Brown. I've been a homeowner and a business owner in San Luis Obispo County for the past 35 years. I am here today to speak to you about the radioactive waste generated by the nuclear power plant that has been our neighbor for 25 years. Our government has not provided a central storage facility for the waste generated by 103 nuclear plants across our country. And the closest timeline for a repository to be authorized, built, and begin accepting waste is 2017. There is a big if attached to this timeline. Nobody wants this deadly stuff in their neighborhood. How much of this waste are we expected to live with, and for how long? Someone will have to live with it for thousands of years, and the costs are astronomical. We must be concerned not only with the security of all 103 plants and repository, but also the transport across our country of the thousands of tons of waste. I live 1.6 miles from a radioactive reactor applicants to cover your budget. Isn't this a conflict of interest? To relicense existing aged plants and to build new ones before there has been a waste repository established would be criminally irresponsible and unacceptable. I have two questions, and part of it has been answered, I believe. How vulnerable is the plant, reactors, and spent fuel pools to attack from the air similar to the 9/11 attacks? Is the airspace protected? And would there be time to react if someone chooses to attack from the air? This vulnerability was highlighted on June 1st of this year when a Greenpeace activist flew an ultralight aircraft over a nuclear power plant in Flamanville, France. How vulnerable are we here? My second question is, have you reconsidered your refusal to share classified information with scientists of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences with high security clearances so the risks of terrorist attacks on these shipments of nuclear fuel and waste can be evaluated? Thank you.
I actually had three questions out there from that, and I appreciate your comments and your statement. One of them was on conflict of interest about fees. I'll answer that one first. We do have funding that is provided to us out of the Congressional General Fund. We don't receive payment directly from utilities or anyone using radioactive materials. But you are correct that we charge, depending on the costs of our operation, we charge those fees back to those licensees that we regulate, and they then pay that fee back to the U.S. government in the general fund. And that was by order of Congress that we have a fee-charging process for that. But we don't get directly paid from them. In fact, that would be a conflict of interest if we did. We do not. We are an independent agency for that purpose. The second question was, how vulnerable are we to an attack from the air, and would there be time for us to react? I guess I'll have Barry Westrich answer that, but I'll start out with a couple of general comments. Any infrastructure system like a nuclear power plant is vulnerable to an attack from many means, and so we structure our response to prevent that, to mitigate it, and respond to it for air, water, and land type attacks. We purposely don't disclose those for obvious reasons. We don't want to give people an advantage if they do decide to do that. But we have taken a lot of steps to look at and analyze what some of those scenarios might be and have determined things that were needed in addition to what they were at the plants to protect them from a security standpoint and from a mitigation standpoint. The part of those are what I just talked about and Barry talked about, these phases of analyses. So you people have raised this, I think, since we've been meeting here in 2003. It's a good issue. I think you've helped us continue to look at the issue. The energy bill, actually, I understand your viewpoints about it, but it had other things in there. And some of those other items in the energy bill were for us to look further at some of these areas. So it had some of those good things in it. Would we reconsider our refusal, I think was the third question, to share information with scientists? I don't know the particular scientists you're talking about, but that's what I thought it was. Thank you for clarifying that. For those of you who didn't hear, it was the National Academy of Science scientist, and can you speak to that, Barry? Because if you can, I can.
I don't. I know there was some dispute between us and them about release of information. I'm not sure how that.
Well, I can tell you what I know then.
Aircraft. And if we have that information, if it relates to a particular facility or a group of facilities or an area of the country, the first thing we do is notify licensees that there is something that's going on, there is a threat stream in their area, and we either make recommendations of actions to take or put them on alert that we'll get back to you if we have any further information. We've taken a lot of additional steps to work with both the FAA and NORAD to have protocols in place to deal with situations where FAA identifies something going on with an aircraft. And this can be small aircraft or large aircraft. FAA is monitoring the airspace, particularly around all the reactors. They know where the reactors are. They sit, with NORAD next to them. So everybody's clear that these facilities are critical infrastructure. If they see something, they notify us, and they also get in touch with the licensees. So there is actions that are taken if any kind of aircraft situation occurs. It goes through our operations center directly to the licensee, and then we get on the phone, and we've developed procedures in conjunction with licensees on immediate steps to take if they're notified that an aircraft attack is imminent or if it's some distance away. There's certain steps that licensees will take to prepare for that eventuality. Well, the other thing that happens if we identify something going on with an aircraft is the military scrambles fighters to try to intercept the aircraft. I can't tell you if we have enough time or not. It depends on when it's identified that there's a situation that involves an aircraft and the aircraft has changed course or it's dropped to elevation or it's heading.
If it was an act of a madman, say, in the off chance, instead of a planned attack.
In a hijacked situation, we would probably know about it. In other situations with smaller aircraft, we may or may not know about it. And that goes to the third step that we were alluding to, is these mitigative strategies. So if that does occur, if an aircraft does impact a facility, we have done extensive efforts to work with licensees to develop mitigative strategies on both physical things they could do, putting the plant in a particular configuration to best mitigate and be able to respond you know, moving personnel to locations that they could be able to respond after something like this occurs?
The thing that concerns me the most is the spent fuel pools. They're not in a containment, are they? They're just out there on a cement plaid, a pad. Is that correct?
Well,
they're
not in a containment? The spent fuel pools are typically in a building, okay, in the facility. Some are below grade. Others are above grade. But in both those situations, we've done extensive studies to determine what the impacts are, even from the largest type of aircraft. And we've had licensees do a myriad of things to move fuel to certain configurations that's better for cooling, and increase their ability to add water if something were to occur.
It's not all in one situation there, one placement. It's spread out in different areas.
Well, it's in the spent fuel pool, but we've mandated certain configurations that are better for cooling.
Like the dry cask area, they'll be in different places instead of one contained area in the dry cask situation?
Yeah, let me answer that on the dry cask. Each of the systems that we have on display here, canisters, as we refer to them, are stored in a...
Next question.
My name is Jane Swanson. I'm representing the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. On June 2nd of this year, the Federal Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, ordered the NRC to study the possibility of terrorist attack on the dry cask storage project at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Plant, as required under the National Environmental Policy Act. I'm pretty amazed that PG&E has made recent statements indicating that it intends to proceed with construction of the dry cask project as planned. So my question of you is, why is not the NRC ordering PG&E to stop the project until the NRC has complied with or at least responded to the ruling of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals?
Yeah, thanks, Jane, for that question. As I indicated earlier, we are in the process, and you picked up on it, of evaluating what would be our response to that. But in the meantime, the construction of the facility, if they proceed to do it, they're under no order to stop that construction, as you indicated. And we, at this point, until we evaluate what our response is to that, are not going to give any kind of order like that until we complete our evaluation and decide what we're going to do. But I would also indicate that we are in litigation, and we have to be careful what all we say until our commission makes that decision. But the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals indicated that what we didn't do, if I read it right, was that we didn't factor the evaluation of threat assessments and terrorism into the review of the environmental assessment. But I want to assure you all, we have reviewed for this dry storage facility the impacts and threats from terrorism on that facility as part of our security and safety review. So it's not like we have not done that review.
A quick follow-up.
Sure.
I know that one reason you're here is to build confidence in the community because you're wanting the community to have more confidence that the NRC truly is concerned with our public health and safety. So I'll just restate that the fact that the NRC, yourselves, have not ordered PG&E to suspend construction of the dry cask storage project, what it looks like to those of us who live here is that you are not even holding the door open to the possibility that there might be mitigations put in place at some point in time. In other words, that the dry casks might be scattered so they're less of a target, so that they might be behind a berm, so they might be under a roof of some kind. It sounds like you don't actually intend to even keep the door open to making changes.
Yeah, I understand your issue, and the door is open. Even if we weren't under the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that we had to review, if something comes up during the construction, or if we, through our assessments that Barry Westrich talked about, find out that
difficulty trusting what we hear, because we have not been told what we need to know. We're the ones that live here. We're the ones that have the concerns, and yet we don't hear it. And it's the same thing that we're putting up with our administration in Washington, D.C., this secretive policy. And it seems to be so widespread that we're all cautious and not trusting. And when I agree that when we see that no hold after this appellate decision was made, the ruling was made, that no hold has been put on PG&E, how will we ever know that really PG&E is doing what they're supposed to be doing? We don't really know those things. And we don't have a history of trusting that we're going to hear those things accurately. So I know that it's the same old rhetoric about, well, if we tell you, it's like telling the terrorists. Well, I don't really believe that that's true to that extent. I think there's a lot that you could share with us. And if you truly are here to build relations, then we've got to break through some of that old history that we have with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your comments. Let me address a couple of those. The issue of secrecy policy with the NRC and PG&E, if it's connected to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, that decision was made with the understanding that the NRC will have time to review that to determine our next course of action. That's a fairness in doing that, and we have to evaluate that. And I don't want to preclude a decision by our commissioners prior to them making that decision. So it's not a secrecy. It's a matter of a process that it has to go through. But by August 31, when the Court of Appeals has given us to respond, we'll have that. The other piece about how do we know we're doing the right thing, I understand your question and your issue. Part of what we are doing here and meeting with you all is to try and answer questions. You'll have to be the judge whether you think we're doing the right thing or not. We're not trying to convince you one way or the other. All I can tell you is our mandate is to make sure if the facility is built, that it's built to the best standards and to the safety that it's required, and we'll make sure that that occurs. But there is no secrecy as far as responding to you about the Ninth Circuit. It's a matter of due process and letting that take its course.
You had a question?
Yes, I do. Are you going to hold it for me? Good. June Von Ruden.
Tony, before you go on, I think PG&E wanted to make a response here.
Thank you, Dr. Mallett. I wanted to address this from PG&E. My name is Donna Jacobs, Vice President, Nuclear Services. And we want to maintain from PG&E an environment of open and honest communications. If you look into our values that we have as a corporation, one of those values is open and honest communications. And we've been demonstrating that from our CEO throughout the company. And so if there's areas where you feel like you'd like more information, we can direct you to people to help answer questions that you have. I know that Dr. Mallett addressed it from the Ninth Circuit Court, and also I'd address it from security. There are things that information that is sensitive and that we can't share, but if there's questions that you have that we can provide.
Not amused, really, but a mock missile rolling off a flatbed truck that's supposed to, if it were real, have a nuclear warhead on it, rolling down a bank and scaring New York City. And also, what was my other funny one? It wasn't funny. The ship tilting 15 degrees, a big new ship, the best rules, the best protocol, the best plan. My point being that I think, including Chernobyl and including Katrina, I have a friend in Washington, Homeland Security, a lot of good rules, a lot of good plans, a lot of review. It didn't work. And so my question finally is it your role at all to look at human error and track human error in any of these preparations or drills for the security since 9/11?
Yeah, if I understand the question, you're asking about what's our role in looking at human error in these and do we allow for that? Is that
right.
Correct? Yeah.
That's correct.
When we look at dry cask storage or any other operation in the nuclear facility, we look at, obviously, equipment that's in that facility, how it's structured, how it's built, and make sure it's built appropriately. Then we look at procedures, and are those procedures correct? And the licensees building them do that as well. But we also look at the people, and we try to look at where could things go wrong, and where those can go wrong, we take steps to say, well, you can't do it that way, or you need to try some other method to do that. And that's my general response, that yes, we do look at human error from looking at the procedures and the people that operate the items. We also look at experience of issues that have occurred in the past. And Barry Westrich mentioned we look at assessments of what occurs around the world in the area of security and attacks on various facilities, some of the inhumane attacks that occur overseas. And we look at those to learn from those and say, what is it that could happen at this facility similar to that? So that we can try and account for some of that, because we recognize that we may have thought about all the things we could, but it might not be all-inclusive. And from a human error aspect of did we forget something, we try to look at that constantly.
Well, I just wanted to add, one of the things we do specifically for human error, and you're right, errors can occur, is these drills that we conduct. And with regard to aircraft, we've conducted drills with each licensee. We're going to continue to conduct drills. So as we have these drills and they become familiar and comfortable with the notifications they're going to get and the actions that they're supposed to take and the sites, go through those actions that they're supposed to take, and it becomes more and more familiar with them as time goes on, those error rates, will go down. We also do that both in the physical security area. We have force-on-force drills, which are a performance test of all the things that the facility is doing in physical security to see if they can actually defend the plant against, the DBT characteristic attack. And those are conducted frequently. The licensees are required to do many a year.
Okay. I'm Terry Jackson, and I'm the senior resident inspector there at Diablo Canyon. I also have Tim McConnell, who's the resident inspector at the site, and our offices are located there at the site, and we spend our day-to-day job is to go throughout the facility and observe operators, but also we observe the security personnel, and are they alert. We observe what kind of human performance issues that they may have and how the site is addressing those, and we also observe the security equipment and its condition. And how is PG&E correct in equipment problems with security? So we're there on a day-to-day basis, and we get to see what kind of problems that security personnel have and what they're dealing with, and also to ensure that they're correcting those problems.
So I think our answer to your question was yes, we do factor in human error, and those are the ways that we do it. So. Tony, I'm sorry again, but I think PG&E wanted to add something to that. I'm sorry.
So you can tell from the response that as an industry, human performance is something we take very seriously. I think it would be appropriate. I'm Jim Becker, the station director at Diablo. I think it would be appropriate from the standpoint of the licensee to talk about what we do about human performance, because if there is an emergency at the plant, it will be our folks who respond to that and who we are counting on. And so I will say that not a week goes by at Diablo Canyon that we are not practicing our human performance skills and our ability to respond to an emergency in some way. That may be simulator training with our operators. It may be training or drills for our emergency response organization. It may be classroom training, but we are constantly training on these issues and reinforcing good human performance tools, which allow us to avoid errors, because we recognize that we are human beings. Human beings can make mistakes, and so we learn from that, and we put tools in place to prevent such errors. And those tools are things like teamwork, where we back each other up and we independently verify what we're going to do both before we do it and after we do it. We have communications protocols to make sure that when we communicate with each other, we're not misunderstood and we have the right intention before we take an action. and standards for following procedures. And I could go on and on, but I think you get a sense from the response you've gotten here. As an industry, we take human performance and error reduction very seriously. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Lynn Levine, and I've been in San Luis Obispo for quite a while and been very involved in Diablo Canyon way, way back. I hate to belabor this whole business about the Ninth Circuit Court decision, but I'm really very puzzled by when it seems to me the experience that I've had with the legal processes of this country is that when a court decides something, that it has to be adhered to. The court decided to have a further study. Study comes up and says, well, the casks that you're using now, PG&E, are not adequate. We'll have to have different ones. And while the study is going on, PG&E is just going on doing what they decided they were going to do without any, thinking about what the court says. So what happens when or if you guys decide that what PG&E is doing with the dry casks is not adequate? And we'll have to start all over again or do something different. What happens to all the money and the effort and everything that's been spent while they're just going on? That's something that I really am very puzzled about, and I'd like to know what your plan is if there is a change.
Let me try again on that. If I understand, the issue is there were two aspects to that. If I don't get them right, please correct me. The first one was in the court system, when they mandate something to, in this case, the NRC, why don't we adhere to that, that we have to adhere to that or something to that effect. The second was if you do an evaluation later on and you find problems with the facility, that's going to cost money to replace those, and so what happens to that? Why wouldn't you stop that now, I guess, so you don't have that? I think that was the gist of the question. Did I get those two right?
Well, what they're doing now is costing money.
Right.
And if it's found that that's not the proper way to go about things, that's going to be all down the drain.
Well, let me take those in order. As far as adhering to the decision, the NRC is adhering to the decision. The decision gave us time to evaluate it and decide what our response is going to be, and that's what we're doing. And also did not say that we have not looked at terrorism as it relates to the dry cask storage facility. What it said was that we looked at it from a safety and security aspect, but we didn't put it into our environmental review of the facility. So it's not that we haven't done it. As far as the second question, there is no if. When that decision is made, and we find something that's not built correctly, or we find during that review something needs to be changed, we will ask the licensee to do that, and could, if they don't, order them to do that change.
To order them to do after the fact?
Well, I don't believe it is, because I think you have to first decide what is it that we haven't reviewed that we haven't already reviewed. That's what the first decision has to be made. And I think, if you build something wrong and you have to change it later, that is costly, and you are correct on that. It's better to build it right the first time. And if we have to do the review and we find that review finds something else, that you are correct. That's money that's spent that you might have had built into design in the first place and wouldn't have had to spend.
Gravely concerned about the safety of the storage process that's being proposed, the storage method that's being proposed. I am a plain speaker, so I'm going to say exactly as it appears to me. it appears to me that it's a foregone conclusion that the dry cask method that's being proposed will go through regardless of what a judicial body has to say. And the only thing, the only logical thing that I can gather from that is that whoever's going forward with that and spending the money wouldn't be doing that if they thought that was going to be a sunk cost and a lost investment down the road. So obviously they feel they've got their political connections tight enough that it doesn't matter what some study says, that they'll be able to smooth this over. And that's what it appears, despite all of the logical, analytical discussion that I see going on here. That's what this appears to be, that there, it's a foregone conclusion that the storage method will go forward regardless. And I think that's extremely insensitive to, first of all, how the community might respond, and I think it does a disservice to the intelligence of the people in this community to presume that the project should just go forward without responding to the judicial manifesto that's been given at this point. And I think the only prudent thing to do for a corporation in this position would be to put the whole program on hold for 30 or 60 days to complete the process of review and come up with some finding. And I think that it appears to be extremely insensitive on the part of PG&E to push forward regardless. I'd like to also just say this. I asked the question earlier today what the half-life of these highly radioactive materials were, and nobody on the panel was able to give me a straight answer, and it's a simple question. I was told that question might be answered later, and that only gave me concern that maybe nobody on the panel happens to know what that half-life is, but I could guess that it's not tens of thousands of years, that it's hundreds of thousands of years, that the material is going to be highly radioactive. If it's only 20,000 years on the low end, the casks are only designed to last 20 to 100 years. How can we plan and gamble with the future of posterity on such an iffy technology as that? Now, I asked about whether or not there had been any FMEAAs on this, failure modes and effects analyses. I had not really received a clear response to that question. I assume some of you are engineers and that you understand what FMEAs are. And I don't know that that type of analysis has been done. What I hear are very general reassurances. Believe us, we've got it all under control. We do our drills, we dot our I's, we cross our T's, we've done our homework, and everything's just the greenhouse emissions reduced in the state of California. I would find that technology to be far more safe and a far more sane solution than continuing on the path that we're currently on. Nothing happens to any surrounding area if you destroy a coal-fired plant. It's still a strategic target. So I would just beseech you all to think about paradigm change. What we really need to evolve is a renewable alternative other than nuclear, even if it means the nature of all of your jobs change and there are other corporations involved instead of the current players. We really need to be thinking about the consequences for posterity, not 20 or 30 or 100 years out, but 500 years out. We should be thinking about what we give our children and their children and the children after them. My ancestors came to this country in 1635, and I know the history of every generation of my family from that period. And I take great pride in this country. And I have enormous confidence in the method of government that we have. I find that it has failed us where corporations are allowed to make major decisions and small governing bodies are allowed to regulate them in a manner that everything is just allowed to proceed as business as usual, and one has to ask what the conflict of interest might be. I have to ask that question. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thanks. Let me respond to that first. As far as political connections and allowing to proceed business as usual, the NRC's role is to make sure the facilities are designed and constructed safely and to operate safely once they're built. We are doing that, and we are not politically connected for that. In fact, if we don't do that, we will not be able to function as an organization in the future. So we have to make sure that those facilities are built and designed and operated safely. So there is no political connection other than we take orders from Congress if we don't do it correct from a safety aspect. As far as business as usual, we have not taken any action different, you are correct, than to allow them to continue to construct this facility. They are at risk, as the other lady indicated, that if we come back later and say that there's more evaluation we did and they have to change something, they will have to change that in order to comply with our requirements. But right now, our Court of Appeals decision has asked us to review this and determine what our response is, and we're going to abide by that at this point in time. As far as you did ask earlier, and we looked for you at the earlier meeting, as you recall, we said we wanted to give other people a chance to ask questions. It wasn't that we're not trying to give you an answer on the two questions you asked about half-life and what materials were considered as far as weaponry and that for a response that has to be dealt with when you deal with nuclear as an alternative to energy is the waste. You are correct on that. As far as did we evaluate the facility for certain type weapons and certain type aircraft, we do speak in general terms, but it's not that we're trying to keep things from you. We're trying to keep things from those individuals that would take that and use it to determine what they could attack these facilities with most appropriately to do the most damage. So we do protect that information. We're not trying to hide it. You can believe me or not believe me, but we are not. We just do not want to give anyone who has this idea that they can take this weaponry and attack these facilities any advantage if we can prevent it. So I don't know, Barry, you want to say anything more about that, or Ray?
Yeah, let me add one more thing. You mentioned the failure modes effect analysis, and what I'm thinking of you're talking about there is basically an accident analysis, and each one of the dry cast storage systems has a whole chapter that deals with accident analysis and the types of accidents that could occur to that cast system and how it's to be defended in case it does, such as a impact from a missile during a tornado or that type of thing. So those things are looked at in a great deal of detail. And the other side of that, I think Bruce has addressed relative to if it was attacked by a terrorist type organization.
Tony, if you could get to this gentleman in the green shirt first, and then we'll go over to the other side of the room. I noticed that person over here. Yes, you. We'll get to you next.
Sure. My name is Hugh Wadman. I retired here to San Luis Obispo 10 years ago from a lifetime in profession of chemistry, working primarily in areas of concern for the health sciences, during which time I use radioactive tracers, etc. I have absolutely no connection whatsoever to the nuclear power industry, other than a couple of my students moved on to work in similar areas. It was hot when I came in here. You may have noticed it. It's been getting hotter. We've been burning carbon for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, when every single kilowatt of electricity that came out of that carbon could have been replaced with nuclear. The reactors are 25 years old. The rest of the world is building new technologies. France relies for 80% of its electricity on nuclear and practically none on carbon. Surely there's an air of irrelevance to these comments. we need to be worried about what's happening now to our atmosphere. The nuclear industry in this country has had no significant impact on health since the first day it arose. And don't quote Three Mile Island. You could have stood at the front gates and you would have had less than three single chest x-rays during the whole time. Yes, somebody who works in the industry is taking a higher than average load of radiation damage. But few who work in the industry are taking as much as an airline captain. There's an air of unreality about this meeting blown at Hiroshima. And the chap who taught it showed us how to make a bomb. It wasn't a very good bomb, but it was basically the version that was blown at Hiroshima. He had no inside knowledge at all. He later went on to get a Nobel Prize for his work in totally other areas that had more to do with health than anything else. I followed the area of nuclear physics just because of an interest in nuclear power and its relationships to the environment. And I'm very, very disturbed about the extent to which people who have good intentions have moved completely and totally away from any put-on-the-ground knowledge of their subject. I challenge the majority of the people who are standing up and raising these type of environmental concerns today to answer the question, to what extent do they have any basic understanding of the nature of radioactivity? The basic, in this country, 1% or less of our dose of radiation comes from civilian activities. Some 10 to 15% comes from medical uses. And Chernobyl, yes, an absolute insanity. They built a reactor that they were told way, way back had no safety measures in it whatsoever, so-called improper void factor, that it was capable of a runaway. And it ran away. Still the damage, the radiation from Chernobyl, is less than is being dumped on this country by the uranium and radioactivity that comes from burning coal. I think that's all I have to say. I really think that we should be supporting these gentlemen, not continuously harassing. We need your help.
Good evening. My name's Carrie Filler, and I don't have the exact date for this gentleman, but I don't know if you've done any research about that. I believe it was a Santa Susana reactor research in Simi Valley in the 1950s. Just do some research on that, and I think you might be enlightened in some problems that have gone on there. And another comment to his, if I may. I think we don't need to be adversarial in these things. We're all interested in our safety for ourselves, for the future. And I've often seen it'd be pitted between environmentalists and the nuclear industry is like the choices don't have to be to drown or burn up because of global warming, nor should it be, you know, glowing. You know, it's not drowned or glow. There's other choices out there, I believe. And, but that's sort of my philosophy. I have a question coming up. I had another point to say. Someone had asked, was there any political connections to the NRC? Aren't some of your superiors actually politically appointments, I believe, and someone can answer that. Another comment to someone else's question, what do we do if it turns out to have been the wrong thing to do, like if the overpacks turn out to have not last for 20 years and they have to repack them? In the history of Diablo Canyon, there's never been an oversight too big that hasn't been able to be paid for by the ratepayers. The buildings were built backwards after they found an earthquake. Question, how long do you foresee the radioactive being on site at Diablo? To which he responded he believed it would be gone within 10 years. 10 years would probably solve the asbestos problem because we wouldn't really need it if it was all gone within 10 years. What does he know that we don't know? Because I believe he's with the nuclear section of PG&E. So maybe it's a PG&E question. And I think that's it. Thank you.
The PG&E want to take that last question?
I'm Donna Jacobs again. While I don't know the specific comments that were made at that hearing, so I can't talk specifically to what Mr. Jack Keenan might have mentioned there.
He was asked the question twice and he answered. He was asked the question twice and stated it twice, so I don't know how to get a... Would that be something you could look up and answer my question? Because that's sort of concerning to me. He said that under oath.
Definitely we can follow up with that, and I will talk with him personally to find out what his response was. And also looking at the timing, if we look at just what's happened within the last week, I believe there's been discussion that's been put out about the timing for Yucca Mountain, which now projects it out to the 2017 timeline. So obviously the statements that he may have made did not take into consideration the information that just came out last week. So I think that may be part of it, is the timing of when we've just heard of what the release now will be projected for Yucca Mountain, but I'll definitely follow up. I'll talk with Jack and see what we've got from that.
You had a first question, though, about aren't some of our superiors political appointees? Yeah, we do have a five-person commission that runs our agency. Each of those commissioners is proposed by the President of the United States, and they are then confirmed by the U.S. Senate before they can take office. I can say, and so they are political appointees, but we do some things for checks and balances on that. One is, if you've ever listened to the confirmation hearings, they are grilled heavily on what their positions are on safety. And the other is, there's a balance on the commission that are going to meet on an issue, they have to do it in public if there's more than two of them at the same time. Also, there are mandates that have to be appointed from different parties and for a five-year term as ways of trying to keep them independent of political ties. I would say that the NRC is, as far as alternatives, and I appreciate comments on both sides of the issue. We don't support one alternative over another, and some people laugh when I tell them that because we're the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But our mandate is to assure that if it is nuclear, we will make sure it's safe and meets our requirements if it's built or in operating. So we aren't supportive of one alternative or another, but if it is nuclear, we make sure it's operated safely. Did that answer your question on political appointees? Thanks.
Yeah, my name is Jack Bisek. I live in Sea Canyon. We were promised storage at Yucca Mountain by, 1998? Why not hold off on nuclear power until that is approved and sanctioned?
That's a good question. As I said before, our role in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is to not support or deter from nuclear power. Our role is to make sure that they are built appropriately if it's a nuclear plant and that they operate safely. As far as should we have nuclear power in this country, that's a question that shouldn't come to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That should go to another body. And I think the energy bill in Congress that was passed has supported that we'll have nuclear power in this country.
Well, sometimes it's those simple questions that you have to ask yourself, that you have to take up the ladder, that you have to stand up and be responsible for. What are your annual salaries? Could you go down the line and please disclose what your annual salaries are?
We can do that. I don't know that that is pertinent to the meeting that we have here. Well, we can talk to you on the side then, because I don't want to disclose salaries or things that are not public information. I can tell you for the senior executives in our agency, and I'm one of those salaries are a matter of public record, and you can obtain those, and we'll tell you how to get those.
Okay, well, you know, your track record, our ability to trust you, the fact that you're probably here because you're mandated to be here doesn't engender a lot of comfort and faith in us, the local residents. How long will we have to manage the waste from Diablo Canyon, assuming it doesn't go to Yucca Mountain? How long will we have to manage that waste?
Well, there's two questions there. One is, you indicated that we are mandated to be here. The NRC is mandated to make sure, as I said before, that these nuclear facilities are operated safely and designed and built safely. We aren't mandated to come meet with you as a public. We felt that was the prudent thing to do based upon what you fed to us in the past, and we are trying to listen to you, and we have been, and we think it's important to have the interchanges, but we aren't mandated to do that. Okay. As far as how long will the waste have to be there, I don't have the answer for you, but I can tell you reality is we licensed the dry storage facility for a 20-year license, and we'll review it at that point in time. But our country has decided that the ultimate disposal is not currently at the nuclear power plants like this dry storage, that it's at the Yucca Mountain facility or a similar repository. But as you heard some people mention, it'll be 10 years at least before, even if you started today on a repository with an application. We have not received an application yet. And once we receive an application, it'll probably be at least 10 years before that's accepting fuel. So you can put that in perspective of it's because we gave a license to Diablo Canyon, and because it's going to take that period of time, you could be 10 to 20 years at least.
So let me get this straight. We're going to start is capable of cracking that in a wink of an eye. So you've heard about North Korea. They don't like us. Afghan, Iraq, Iran. People dislike us. The world is complicated. So why would we want to store this material out in the open and have such a risk of a temptation for attack? And I'm just wondering, why put them all in one place? Why put them out in the open? And why not wait until things settle down before moving ahead with this project? Why not consider conservation? Turn off the lights. Turn off the air conditioner. Look at alternative energy that's not going to harm or damage the earth for tens of thousands of years. So why store these bunkers all in one place out on the coast? Can you give me an answer for that?
I think I heard several questions there, so let me just try to pick up on a couple of them here. One, you talked about cracking the Isfasi pad. Mother Nature could crack the Isfasi pad. That was why they actually poured it 7.5 feet thick, reinforced concrete, was so that it would withstand a seismic event. That's part of the design basis for this plant. As far as why all in one place, they're on one pad. Actually, they will be on two pads, but they're spread out on the pads. And that is an acceptable method for storing the canisters at this point in time. As was mentioned earlier, they may come back later and say it needs to be covered with a shed or something along those lines, but that's not been decided yet. Currently, it's an acceptable method. It's been evaluated, not necessarily in the environmental protection arena, but in the security arena, as far as that it is a safe configuration. And I think that also addresses why the open area, I believe. Is that true or not?
Why would you have it out in the open? Why not have it covered? I mean, you know, a ship, a plane, if there's something to aim for, why don't you paint a target like the classic archer's target with a yellow and a, you know, blue ring on it? Come on. Why not put them in camouflage bunkers or something, you know? Are we tempting fate here, or are these, you know, could it withstand a small aircraft missile launched from a ship?
Well, let me answer that in a slightly different way, but it's still answering your question, I believe. There is a new reg, it's BR0314. It's called Protecting Our Nation, which was issued in 2004. And in this new reg, they actually talk about the vulnerability assessment that was performed for Isfasi type of cask, dry fuel storage cask. And they looked at four different casks, and as part of that, they had actually addressed a aircraft impact similar to what happened on 9/11, as well as a land-based attack. And the determination was that It's very highly unlikely that there would be any release whatsoever radioactivity that would impact people beyond the exclusion zone.
How do you remove the material stored then after 2 years? What's the life expectancy of that device that you described in that?
Well, the device is the cast that is stored in currently.
What's the life expectancy of that?
It's that the ultimate storage of this material will be in a repository. If there are other alternatives we could decide in the country, but we've not made that position. But we have not decided to store long-term beyond the 20 years or 40 years Ray's talking about at licensees' facilities. If we did decide to do that, we'd have to do some different evaluation, certainly, of that. But at this point, our mandate, as you called it earlier, is to find a repository in this country. Yucca Mountain's the current one, and move this fuel out away from the nuclear plants and into that repository. These facilities are not being constructed and built with the purpose of tens, thousands of years storage of that material. So,
I think we'll move on to another question right here.
Good evening. Rick Keller. Jim Becker, congratulations. I hear you're cleaning up the PG&E plant well. I hear there's a lot less odor around. Little inside joke. By the way, PG&E has to follow through with whatever you guys mandate. And we have to follow through with whatever you guys tell us. This is not my first meeting. I hear lots of different things. I hear, thank you for listening. But you guys don't really listen. You're getting paid to be here. You come down. It's a little bit cooler. But I like this article. Finally, the Mothers for Peace got somebody to listen, and at least somebody par or maybe a little bit above you guys, to make you realize our concerns are real. So, little check. About the equivalent amount of electricity I spend to PG&E every year. This one's going to the Mothers for Peace.
I think we had a question over here. Probably one more question. We'll take a break, if that's good with the panel. And then, sir, you'll be after the break. Is that good?
Yeah. Okay. Patrick Clems, New Times. Loughlin, you spoke about gaps in security, which stands to reason, because why would you protect information if there's no gaps in security? But can you give me an idea of what your enforcement policy is, what cards you hold against PG&E to get them to comply with certain standards? Because it would seem to me, and a lot of people in this room, that this opportunity to revoke, at least for a little time, this construction permit would be a good opportunity to, you know, do that very thing.
I think I should take that one. And then as far as gaps in security, Jeff can talk to those. As far as what is our enforcement policy and what can we do, we have a lot of options. We spoke about some of them earlier. We can, if we find a problem with the construction of the facility or if we decide it should be stopped, we can ask the licensee to do that. If they don't comply with that, we can order them to do that. If they don't comply with our requirements in general, what we typically do is we give them a violation for that. We ask them to respond as
for security inside the, you know, at the facility. So the things that we can take enforcement action on are violations of our requirements for physical security and other health and safety requirements. This comprehensive review is not related to requirements. It's not an inspection. It's more of a opportunity for the state and local officials to talk about how they would come to the site in the aftermath of some type of event. So these gaps they're identifying are, for instance, one I heard this morning, if the radios don't have correct operability, the California State Police can't talk to the fire departments, that might be a gap that you'd want to look at, is how do we get those people together so the radios can communicate together. It's not related to requirements, though. So I just wanted to clarify the two areas. We, the NRC, controls the requirements for physical security on-site, and this is looking at the off-site piece. I don't know if you have any.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too. That this has nothing to do with the binding requirements that the NRC enforces at the plant. This is strictly looking at the off-site infrastructure and then coming up with some potential enhancements to their resources so that they can mitigate a terrorist event. Another example would be something like one that comes up often is the number of hospital beds available. You know, do we have enough hospital beds if there's large-scale casualties from an event? So it has nothing to do with the requirements. Just want to clarify.
Yeah, I would add, though, if there is something that comes out of the review that we determine that licensees should take, we'll evaluate that, and we have. Since 2001, we've been doing reviews not dissimilar from this comprehensive review on site, and we have issued orders to licensees to comply with those reviews and the findings from those as we find assessments.
PG&E, want to respond?
Thank you. I'm Donna Jacobs, and I did want to respond to that because what we've been talking about with the comprehensive review is this presidential mandated directive. So that's the requirement. And I want you to know that from our perspective, we've not waited until there's been a mandated requirement to look at this. We have typically met with local law enforcement, with the sheriff and their office, with other off-site agencies to develop strategies so that if something were to happen, we would have the flow of communication and the proper protocols to address it. And in fact, last year we hosted a pilot review for the industry that was attended by I'll miss people if I start going through it, but by our local law enforcement, by sheriff, by Coast Guard, by fire, military presence, FBI, local and national, state presence, both from Department of Homeland Security and the national level Department of Homeland Security, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I can tell you that the drill that we put on for that scenario was an aircraft. And we went through the whole scenario of how we would handle that from the site perspective, how we would interface and who we would interface with from the county, and how the county would then pass that information to the state, and went through all of that. So
okay, if we go ahead and take our seats, I think we're ready to get started again. And the NRC will also be available after this meeting to have any other discussions anyone would like to have with us. With that, turn it back over to Tony.
All right, sir, say your name.
My name's Otto Schmidt. I've lived here for over 40 years. Mr. Bisek's question of asking you about your salaries was, I thought, put quite succinctly as to reasoning that I can find over my 35-plus years of listening to AEC, NRC, and the safety hearings from Diablo or the PG&E, and with the political connections, with the flip-flop plans and the undiscovered faults, and with bringing in people like Casper Weinberger and George Shultz from Bechtel through the Reagan administration to justify putting this plant in and rearmoring different parts of it. I have one question that I asked at the last meeting with the NRC about the protection of the spent fuel pools that are, what are they, was it 5, 6, 8 times capacity that originally was projected, that there's no armoring above them. And I was talking with a Dr. Rosen one time on a tour, he's on your safety commission, about what would happen if an aircraft came in, very unusual incident nowadays in this terror world, but came in and just went straight down in there. He said they were protected from the topography and the containment structures in front. And I said, well, aircraft obviously come from out of the sky. And he was saying, well, that's very rare. Obviously, it is. We had in 1987, I believe it was, where a gentleman, or not a gentleman, but some deranged individual took over an aircraft, Flight 1771, I believe, and drove it into the ground, took over the cockpit and drove it in the ground in Cayucas, inland about, and it's about 10 miles as the crow flies from Diablo. I was wondering, what kind of protections do you have for the spent fuel storage pools? I last time asked that to these people from Texas or Washington or whatever, and the man said that he would be mitigating that problem, and I said, I think more obfuscating that problem. So I'd like to have an answer to that, please.
Well, as I said before, we've done a lot of review of spent fuel pool issues and different aspects of what aircraft could do for a spent fuel pool. I think at Diablo Canyon in particular, there are some hittability issues, as you were alluding to. There's only certain ways that an aircraft can get in to get to that spent fuel pool, so you have to consider, what's the likelihood that someone could actually get there. But that aside, we've done a lot of reviews to determine what the vulnerabilities are of these spent fuel pools. And based on that, and I can't go into all the specifics of that, we've done these phase two security officers training, qualification, weapon systems. There's a whole range of things that have been done to protect the physical structure of other types of explosive devices or attacks. So there's a whole range of things we look at. It's not only aircraft. It's both attack, it's large explosives and aircraft. And we've spent a lot of time trying to evaluate and address that issue.
One last part, excuse me, was it is true, though, that, without exposing, it's anybody's knowledge about, but there is no armoring of the spent fuel pool storage facility, and when you go out there on a tour, you can look directly down on it so that obviously it is approachable. I mean, Dr. Rosen was always saying that, well, it would be with the topography and the two domes that it was obviously protected in that way. So but basically they are not armored or with that anything you have to reveal, but
special service. Actually, I don't know what the roof of that structure's.
I was out there yesterday. I've been there many times, and the roof is not armored for that facility, as you indicate. And we have analyzed for all types of aircraft that could impact on that facility because of that, and we believe we have the right procedures and equipment in place that would properly mitigate those circumstances when they come in there. But you are correct. They're not armored like the containment structure is.
We have a question over here.
Actually, I'm Barbara Scott, San Luis Obispo resident. I'm a bit confused, and I wanted to put out my thinking, sitting here and listening to everyone. Of course we're not physicists and we're not nuclear experts. We are concerned citizens, and I think we do an incredible job because we ask questions from our naivete that I think you look at and are concerned about, and I think that's the beauty of this. And so, when I hear applause, as I did for this gentleman over here, we should also be getting applause because I think we do a very good job at what we do. The fact that we've taken a case, we put enough money together and it was a bake sale situation to have a case in front of the Ninth Circuit, and I think we did an incredible job. I mean, we should be looked at as, hey, why don't we see what the possibilities are for safety here? That's our main issue. I know it feels like harassment. I know often it is harassment, but not because we have any other intention than to make it the safest place that we can have, the safest facility and the safest community. So I just want to have a round of applause for that. Thank you.
Thank you, and Barb, I would tell you also that we get a lot of benefit out of these meetings and the issues you raise.
But I'm just wondering what changes you've made in your programs and what adjustments you've made after that discovery to make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Terry Jackson, and certainly tritium is a concern. Tritium leaks and so forth. There was experiences at other plants where tritium had leaked into the groundwater that was nearby at the plant. At Diablo Canyon, once they received that information about the experiences at other plants, they did go out and they did sample wells that were around the plant. These were some wells that were mainly rainwater that had drained down into these trenches. And we did go out with them and observe some of the sampling they did. We also followed up with the sampling results that PG&E received. And their tritium levels they did receive were not – they did get some tritium in some of this drain water that came off from the rainwater that came off the roof of the buildings. And this tritium is attributed to the normal gaseous release that the plant is permitted to release, and the rain would wash it down onto the buildings and then down into these trenches. But at Diablo Canyon, the water that they did sample, that water is not domestic drinking water. This water drains into the ocean and is accounted for in their normal release program.
So then I'm concerned about what's running off into the ocean and how that's being monitored.
Okay, the gaseous release that is being released, the nuclear power plants, they are licensed to be able to release some radioactive gases and liquid into either the ocean or into the atmosphere. And there are requirements on how much they are allowed to release. And those have been set to limits such that public's health and safety is protected. And so this, the tritium that's being accounted for in some of these wells and so forth, they have already been accounted for when they were released from the plant previously.
I'd like to talk a little bit about from what the agency is doing regarding the tritium. One of the major efforts is they put together a task force, which is ongoing with the NRC and with the industry, and what the primary purpose of this task force is to find better ways to evaluate potential sources of tritium and also to identify if there's other releases of tritium that have previously not been identified, which would include core samples taken of soil around certain plants. So the key is to try to identify it, and then once it's identified, to make sure that it's promptly communicated out to the communities. So that's currently still ongoing.
Question over here.
Hi, I'm Jill Zamek with the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. On January 23rd, the Mothers for Peace submitted comments on the deficiencies of the NRC proposed rule regarding the design basis threat for protection of nuclear facilities against sabotage. And on March 9th, Morgan Rapp.
There is, and I don't have that.
Yeah, but Jill, we can. Was it Jill? Is that correct? If you don't mind me, we need to get you that information. We don't know the exact schedule, but our agency has it, and we can get you that. If you can let us know how to get that to you, we'd be glad to do that.
Hello, I'm Michael Stewart. I represent the North American Young Generation in Nuclear. And while I'm not from around here, I do believe that the issues that are of concern to us concern all U.S. citizens. Therefore, I'd like to make a statement and ask a question at the end. Just to comment on some earlier issues, somebody asked how many reactors have come online since Three Mile Island. Actually, 46 new reactors have come online since Three Mile Island have been issued operating licenses, and that is just about tripled the U.S. nuclear capacity in the United States since Three Mile Island. So it's not just one, it's a whole bunch of them, and they're out there doing their job very safely and have been doing so for a very long time in the United States. Also, somebody mentioned property values. If there was a nuclear accident, I don't know if anybody's checked the property values around Three Mile Island, but they're doing pretty well. Nobody's lost any money on property around that place, despite the accident that occurred there. So, to get on with my statement, I represent a national organization of about 2,000 nuclear people that are engaged in nuclear science and technology. They're engaged in all kinds of fields, not just nuclear power. We're talking nuclear medicine, research. And there are ways that we can use nuclear technology for harmful things, and there are ways that we can use nuclear technology for peaceful and beneficial things, and that is our goal. Before I get started, I'd like to show you a number. This is 2,300. Let's turn it around so everybody else can see. 2,300 represents the amount of tons of used nuclear fuel that has been generated by PG&E in the state of California. Now, that seems like a pretty big number, so I should probably give you something to compare it to. This right here is 30,000. If you see the yellow block on the left, 30,000, the green block is the 2,300. 30,000 represents the number of tons of sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide that was prevented by the use of nuclear power in California. That is a whole lot of waste that is not being generated. When we're talking about waste, we should talk about the waste that nuclear power is preventing as well as the waste that nuclear power is generating. Here's another number, 358,000. Now, as you see, 358,000 practically dwarfs anything before it. 358,000 represents the number of tons of carbon dioxide that is prevented by the use of nuclear energy in California in 1 week. 1 week. I initially put 18.6 million because that represents how much is avoided in a year, but that would have made the amount of nuclear waste, so-called waste, to be a one-pixel high block. The message I'm trying to get across is this. Did anyone notice that I was carrying a mock nuclear pellet in my pocket on the way in here today? This tiny pellet is the equivalent of about 2,000 pounds of coal. Would anyone have noticed if I was carrying 2,000 pounds of coal in my pocket when I came in here today? I think you would have. Ever been harmed by it? Great. However, a Harvard Medical School study has confirmed that about 15,000 people per year die of fossil fuel emissions, and nobody is here protesting fossil fuel plants. However, that is a known killer. 45,000 people die on the interstates every year, but enough of that. I've saved the best news for last. I showed you that little nuclear pellet and how small that is and how small the amount of waste is, which I believe is actually the best thing going for nuclear energy. What people are not sharing with you and what scientists know is that 95% of that used nuclear fuel is recyclable. Now, in a state known for its recycling and conservation efforts, this should come as welcome news. This, contrary to what you may have believed, 95% of this stuff is recyclable, and to dispose of it as waste would be a travesty. This is a valuable resource we're talking about, and it will eventually be recycled, I assure you. It's too valuable of a resource. Now, when I see those used fuel storage casks, I see a beautiful thing. Each one of those used fuel storage casks represents billions of tons of atmospheric pollution that is not emitted into the environment. And you and I can all breathe a little easier because of those used fuel storage casks. Perhaps this is why the founder of Greenpeace, Dr. James Lovelock, actually supports nuclear energy. You should ask yourself why. Okay? The question I have is, I'm sorry, that's Dr. Patrick Moore. Dr. James Lovelock is also a supporter. Sorry about that. Now, my question is a little bit rhetorical because I know the answer. However, not everybody here may know the answer. Is PG&E, a little respect, please, is PG&E the first site that has asked for an independent fuel storage facility, or have there been several of them? How many actually exist in the country?
I was thinking about I should know the answer to that off the top of my head. Unfortunately, I didn't look that exact figure up. I know it's somewhere above 30. There's quite a few dry fuel storage, independent spent fuel storage installations scattered across the country, and this one at Diablo Canyon would nowhere near be the first one.
Thanks for your comments. With regard to recycling, that was the issue I was raising earlier in this country, that we have not made that decision. But that is an alternative that people are weighing right now as to burying it in deep repositories, but that decision has not been made yet. Good comment. Thank you.
Any more questions?
I'm Jerry Lenthal, County Supervisor of the 3rd District, and Diablo Canyon is in the district that I represent. First off, I want to thank you, Dr. Mallett, and your staff. In the year and a half that I've been a supervisor, and before that in my dealings in law enforcement, I think we have made tremendous improvements with our communication and dialogue. And I appreciate the timely response I have, and I'll specifically mention Bill Jones, of getting back to me where I have an email, question, comment, and concern. And the question came up earlier, how are we going to restore or how we improve the level of trust? And I think this is a big part of it. And what I've seen in the last year and a half and from working with you people is I feel you do listen, especially to local government. I thank you for returning my calls, answering my questions. I also thank you for being here. I know you don't have to. And it's meetings like this and the town hall group where we're going to improve.
I was told that they were going to be put on site a few at a time. Well, this indicates that probably you are foreseeing them staying there for quite a while. And at this afternoon's meeting, you also said that even when Yucca Mountain comes on board, we are way down on the list for being transported over there. And transportation is a huge issue in this county. The other thing is that you know that there are stronger state-of-the-art dry storage casks. The caster is built of much heavier metal than the metal and concrete jacketed Holtec cast being used at Diablo. Given the Department of Homeland Security, the NRC, and other federal agencies have all declared nuclear plants to be potential targets of terrorism, why aren't the strongest of these casks being used? Another question was, at the afternoon meeting, you showed that in 2005, they went from green to white in terms of safety issues. They and you said that it was mostly administrative stuff. But that's exactly what June was talking about when she indicated that human error is a factor in this. And that's certainly what has caused a lot of accidents at a lot of places. And so that is a problem. Also, in 2003, they had violations from the that resulted in a huge fine from the state of California. So, you know, there have been some problems. It was with the you're giving me a weird expression, PG&E is giving me a strange expression. It was the hazardous waste facility permit problems. So anyway, I'd like, you know, there is human error, and it bothers me that there's going to be 140 casts up there. Just standing out, waiting to be hit.
Yeah, let me start out, and then I'll ask Ray to speak to the storage canister type. The question I was going to answer was in 2005 in the earlier meeting today, and it sounds like you were at that meeting. Appreciate your coming to both meetings. We talked about a white finding of significance having to do with safety issues. And that is correct. It had to do with emergency responders and qualifications of those responders. And as we said in that meeting, that's an important issue to us that the licensee stay on top of and correct. And I consider that a success in the sense that NRC found that and we made sure that the licensee corrected that issue. That means that we are on the job doing what we should be doing. It was not success in that the licensee did not find that themselves and corrected themselves. We, as far as the cast types and why we're using a certain type or not, I think Ray's probably one of the most experts. Keller, I'll let him address that issue. So,
sure. First of all, I think there's two things to keep in mind. I'm not really sure that a castor cask is really any stronger or more. So from that standpoint, a high seismic cask would be what you would want as opposed to something that would potentially have some problems if you had a high seismic type application. The other thing I was going to try to address, I understood you had a concern with the number of casks. What I should mention is that the license, the site-specific license, was for up to 140 casks. They're only going to build two pads, as Dr. Mallett had mentioned, which holds, I believe, 40 casks. Is that the right number? Up to 40 casks. So they can build more if they need to, but they're not building any more than they need to at this point in time.
That seems to indicate to me, then, that you think that Yucca Mountain will not be in operation, and they certainly won't take our materials because we're really low on the list.
Actually, I look at it just the opposite. I look at it, if I believed it was going to be a long time, I would go ahead and build all the pads and start putting it out there. They're looking at it from the standpoint, I believe, and I don't want to speak for them, but in my view, I would be building just what I need because I don't want to build any more than I have to in case the Department of Energy starts accepting my fuel.
But let me add, whether we argue how many they're building or not, it is a fact, as you say and as we said, that the repository at Yucca Mountain is some time away, and that is at least 10 years away, and that's a long time. So we don't dispute that at all.
Hi, my name is Steven Zawalik. I work at Diablo Canyon. One part of my job is to interface with the NRC at our site, and I just want to say a couple things. I think it's fantastic that you all came here to listen to us and to hear our concerns, and I'd also like to thank the Mother for Peace and all the community for coming and listening and learning. We're all learning tonight, right? In my experience at Diablo Canyon, I'm quite proud of our safety record. I'm quite proud of the fact that we generate essentially emission-free electricity at a very reasonable rate, and quite proud of the fact that we have enough power in the state to power the air conditioners tonight, and that we can all go home and sleep in nice, cool houses and watch TV if we want. I'm happy with what we do out there. I'm happy to work for the NRC. I think you folks are wonderful, very professional, very thorough, and I'm impressed with the history that PG&E has in operating that plant safely and reliably. That's all. Thank you.
Well, actually, two. I'm really older than all of you, I guess. I'm quite sure I am. And
won't comment on that.
All right. So, I don't know if you remember, but what has bothered me over the years is most people in the community don't do this thing. This is just some of us that are, you know, dedicated for 20-some years or something. But I think that the community really believes that there is some really strong shelter over the fuel pools. And I think that it would build more train buildings. They can tuck a plane in between, the dome. And the other thing that bothers me is that it was very dramatic, but that someone could walk into a U.S. hearing and have a strange object in his pocket was very, very startling. But even though it was fake, I found that disturbing. And that's it. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you for the comments. As far as the spent fuel pool, I understand your concerns there. We believe there's the appropriate covering and structures for the spent fuel pools. And the one question, the issue I wanted to clarify was on the airplane. We have evaluated that, and there is not any way an airplane can tuck between the containment structure and where the spent fuel pool is. It would have to drop straight down, and even then could not get into there. So we have analyzed for that, and I'm not... Don't take this as a challenge to you, but I just wanted to clarify that couldn't occur. I did have a question, though, along your issue of the object that was brought into the room. I wanted to make sure I'm clear on this nuclear fuel, that is a mock pellet, right? That's not a real pellet. Is that correct? Because that's what I understood you to say. Is that what you were referring to, was his pellet?
My name is Marilyn Brown. Seismic issues have been brought up, and as we know, the plant is built on the Hosgreave Fault. And I'd like to know, in the case of a nuclear emergency because of an earthquake, has there been any mitigation in case the exit route, like Highway 101, is jeopardized? Is that in your evacuation plans?
I understand your question. I'm not sure that we're qualified to answer exactly the plans in the state and the local county that they have. Is there anyone here from the county tonight that can answer that?
My question was, in case of an earthquake and a nuclear accident, is there any mitigation in the evacuation plans from Diablo Canyon in this county that if the Highway 101 or an egress exit was jeopardized, has that been thought about in the evacuation planning?
Yes, do you want to hold this? Thank you. Good question. My name is Meg Swearinger, and I'm with the County Office of Emergency Services, and I'm happy to take that question for you. I think that we have all practiced and have looked at our emergency plans as far as evacuations, especially during an earthquake, of trying to get as many people out of an area, whether it be for a hazmat spill or for any reason, including a nuclear power plant accident. And, of course, I cannot give you an exact that. Unfortunately, I can't give you an answer because of not knowing the exact scenario of what would it be. But like in any emergency, one takes what the emergency is and deals with the emergency at hand, whether it is a flu or a smallpox or a hazmat or a flood, whatever it is, it has to be dealt with. And at the very beginning, it is a very chaotic, seemingly chaotic, until one can get your arms wrapped around whatever that emergency is. Now, I know I've kind of spread that out a little bit over what the answer would be, but we would have to take a very close look to see what the situation would be and what our plans are that we could get people out of whatever area needed to be evacuated. Does that help?
I appreciate that response also. And the question I know is near and dear to this community, given the seismic activity that has occurred and of course, the San Simeon earthquake of several years ago comes to mind. Of course, we do have the resident inspectors here and Agnes Chan, and they lived through that experience of the San Simeon earthquake, and I know that Agnes's husband was very, very close to where some of the buildings actually fell in Paso Robles. The one thing to remember is Diablo Canyon itself was designed to withstand that type of earthquake, to withstand an earthquake on the Hosgreave Fault, such that you wouldn't be seeing a need to evacuate individuals around the plant from an earthquake itself. The plant is designed up and past the maximum Hosgreave accelerations that could be seen for the San Andreas Fault, and it's been looked at numerous times, as well as the independent spent fuel storage installation. Those were all considered in the design and assuring that the maximum earthquake that could be experienced, the plants would be able to shut down and to cool down and maintain in a safe configuration without endangering the community. But I understand the sensitivity to that issue. Every time I come down here, I have to wonder, am I going to experience what you all have experienced numerous times before? And talking with my residents and with Agnes, the site secretary, it's quite an experience, and I understand why it's an emotional issue with this community because of what is actually occurring. It's not like a tsunami that you get 15 minutes warning. It's not like a hurricane or anything else. It's there, it happens, and you have to deal with it at that time.
Pools would also be secure in the
event? Yes, ma'am. The Springfield pools would be secure. They are also designed to withstand the maximum earthquakes that could be experienced from the Hosgri or from the San Andreas and the other earthquakes in the area. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Dr. Paul DeHaan, and I just come back to answer the Mother for Peace about nuclear power. I just come back from France. Now, France have decided to build additional nuclear power plant, although they're in the middle of all kinds of...
Some of us who feel... Well, we all know that nuclear power can be very, very dangerous for a very long time. And the difference between us in the room is that there's a group of people who feel, yeah, it's very dangerous, but we can deal with it, and the bad thing will never happen. And then there are others of us who feel, but the bad thing really can happen, and it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it at all. It is far too dangerous for far too long. And I guess the people who think nuclear power is okay is because it is clean if there's no accident. It is a good source of energy if there is no accident. And there won't be an accident. But we don't know the future. So that's really all I need to say.
Yeah, thank you. I would make a comment, if I may, is by no means are we up here saying that nuclear power is not without risk. And that it's without hazards. You do have to weigh those, and I think you characterized it very well. There's some people that feel, well, that could happen. There's others that feel, well, if it does, we'll deal with it. I think our role in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to be focused on, if it does occur, what are we going to do and pre-plan for that. You've heard several people talk about we put equipment in place, we put procedures in place. We've talked tonight about putting additional things in place as we've analyzed. I think what you need to worry about is that the NRC ever stops asking those questions and looking for those, because if we do, then I think we're becoming complacent. I think we need, as well as the licensee, to continually look for those areas where what is not good enough, what do we need to improve on, because it could occur. I'm not trying to pacify anyone by that comment. It's just it's a fact of life. It could occur, and we need to be prepared for it and how we can respond to it. So I appreciate that comment.
You got it. Hello, I'm Ken Schrader. I work at Diablo Canyon, and I'm a strong supporter of safe, clean, reliable nuclear energy. We've heard a lot of comments tonight from people about the spent fuel pools. And I think a lot of the concerns that people have with the spent fuel pools are due to the fact that they believe that the fuel in the spent fuel pools is the same as the fuel when it's being operated in the reactor. And so I thought that it maybe be helpful to the public if the NRC could describe some of the differences between the fuel in the spent fuel pool versus when it's operating at full power in the reactor, the relative radioactivity levels, the fact that the fuel is covered with a large amount of water in the spent fuel pools. Thank you.
Okay. Clearly, when the plant is in power operation, the heat down, you do have to maintain cooling within the reactor vessel itself, and that is done through either through heat removal through the steam generators out through the secondary plant or through the residual heat removal system, which is the shutdown system to maintain the reactor cool. During refueling activities, that fuel is transferred over to the spent fuel pool. While in the spent fuel pool, the thermal output of the reactor fuel continues to decay off. You do have to continue to supply cooling to the fuel for a period of time, I think up to about 3 years with the water cooling and using spent fuel pool cooling systems before you can actually take it out and allow for air cooling within the dry cask. But there is a decrease continually of the thermal output of the fuel over time, and that's what allows for the transfer of the fuel over a period of time. The fuel that is, of course, most concerned is the fuel that just recently came out of the reactor, fuel that's been in the spent fuel pools for 10, 11, 12 years. That is fuel that could be moved into an independent spent fuel storage installation and cooled in the dry storage configuration. So the gentleman is right. Over time, you do end up with substantial decay of the thermal output of the fuel over time. And just to note that from an overall safety standpoint, the NRC has determined that the storage of spent fuel in either the spent fuel pool or if it is transferred to the independent spent fuel storage installation, that both configurations are safe.
I think we have time for a couple more.
Quick idea. How many more questions do we have from the audience?
I know we had one here and then back
two,
here.
Two, three, four. All right, let's make sure that we get to those four individuals.
Good evening. My name is Kelly Taylor, and I'm here from Virginia. I'm not from the local area, but I believe that when issues happen at one nuclear power station, they affect issues for communities in all nearby all nuclear power stations. I've had the benefit of attending these meetings even in several NRC regions, and I would like to tell those of you who have not had that benefit that this meeting is not typical, and the NRC does not habitually do this everywhere where they give the annual report card on the power stations. I would like to commend you all for giving the public this opportunity to speak, and not just to speak to you, but to share their views with each other, to give a common dialogue so that each can hear what the other issues are, and to basically elevate the level of discussion so that when you know what the concerns are, you're more able to address them. There was a comment earlier this evening about, maybe it wasn't phrased this way, but it struck me as a question of leadership. When we talk about other countries that don't like the way the U.S. policies act and, you know, this country doesn't like us and that country doesn't like us, to me it comes down to a question of leadership. If you're going to make decisions that affect the people that you're responsible for, it's not a popularity decision. You don't go out and do whatever's the most popular. You do what the most responsible thing is. In conjunction with that, I'd like to commend PG&E for what is obviously a good report for how they have operated their facility for the last year, better for the environment. And I support safe, clean, reliable nuclear energy because I believe it's the best technology that we have available today as a baseload, inexpensive source of power to bridge the gap until we have a better resource available. Now, I'm not saying that it's the panacea, the answer to everything, but it will cover us until we can come up with something better. And there is not a technology out there that can do it for the cost of the power produced and that can do it at a baseload power production, stay at 100% inexpensively all the time the way nuclear can. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Susan Attlee from San Luis Obispo. I live downwind from the nuclear power plant. Our insurance policy will not insure us for leakage of radioactivity from a plant or from a storage unit. And I understand that none of the other insurance policies for property owners will do that either. It seems to me, before you even open a nuclear power plant or renew a license, the government and or PG&E should be feel confident enough to be able to give us insurance on our properties. Thank you.
Yeah, we are not experts on insurance, but there are laws in this country that do provide insurance for certain type disasters, including a nuclear disaster. I don't know the details of that. I think the same subject came up during the December meeting we had with you all, but I do know that it does cover some property, but it's not private to individuals. It's allowed by the country. Can you help us out on this, please? We need to get to the microphone.
Yeah, I'm Richard Locke, attorney for PG&E. There is a statutory provision, the Price-Anderson Act, that provides insurance coverage and protection for third parties who are harmed in case of any nuclear incident. I think the total amount of coverage is about $10.3 billion. It's fully funded by insurance from the utilities. I think it's about a $400 million primary layer. And the rest is made up of retrospective premiums that would be paid by all nuclear power plant operators in accordance with the number of reactors that they operate. So, in effect, the nuclear industry is assuring that there is protection out there for people who may be harmed in either person or property as a result of a nuclear incident.
Yeah, thank you for that. We also have some information on that Price-Anderson Act. And I don't know, where's Victor? Victor, is that on our website, or how can they get that if they want some more information?
Yeah, it's on the website, and I'll get all the
okay, thanks.
Yes, my name is Lloyd Clough, and I'm director of the Geosciences Department for PG&E, and I manage earthquake risk for all of PG&E's facilities. And I didn't think seismic would come up tonight. Acceleration there was a little bit less than 5% of G, about 4% of gravity, which is not very much. We in the NRC did inspections. There was absolutely no damage. But what we saw in the vicinity at Paso Robles, where the ground motions were about double that or a little bit more than double, one building partially collapsed and killed three people. And so when I came down to testify before the Board of Supervisors on the San Simeon, there was a draft resolution against Diablo Canyon because of the San Simeon earthquake. I tried to put it in context of what the earthquake risk really is in this county. And it's not Diablo Canyon or the modern buildings. It's the unreinforced masonry buildings like the one that partially collapsed in Paso Robles. And San Luis Obispo is one of the cities that has the most. Now, I worked and volunteered to work with the Board of Supervisors Seismic Task Force and urged them to move ahead. And I understand now they have a priority set to have all of the unreinforced masonry buildings retrofitted by the owners within about the next 15 years. So that's the kind of progress we like to see. That's where the risk really is.
Hi, my name is Pierre Dubay. I'm an employee of PG&E, and I work at Diablo Canyon, and I'm proud to work there. I have worked as a consultant for over 20 years around the U.S. and the world, and I've chosen to work permanently here at Diablo Canyon, and this group is, I have yet to meet a more committed, intelligent, talented staff than is at Diablo Canyon. I didn't always feel this way. I'm a biologist by education, and in the 80s, I was an aggressive naysayer to nuclear power. I regularly protested at Seabrook Station in New Hampshire, and I just didn't think nuclear power was a smart deal. Well, there are a few things that changed my mind through the years. One of them, as the gentleman earlier mentioned, when I started learning about the tons of pollutants that are emitted by coal and oil-fired plants, and how many people die of that. And one thing that really struck me was that it's mostly little kids with asthma that die from that. And the idea of watching a little kid suffocate, this for me, I'm not trying to change anybody's mind, this is what changed my mind. I just couldn't live with that. And then the second thing is I was a really avid backpacker in the Adirondack Mountains of New York and in the Green Mountains of Vermont and the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and I went regularly to these places, and I saw the degradation that occurred from acid rain. I saw ponds and lakes that used to have fish stop having them. And those two things together really turned changed my mind, and I am now an avid supporter of nuclear power. Thank you.
I think we have time for one more.
Hi, my name is Megan Wilson. I work at Diablo Canyon, and I'm a second-generation nuclear employee. And I'm also a first-time mother, and a lot of people think that maybe...
After the Sierra Club, just a few comments on some of the previous comments by various speakers. I don't think anybody in this room would really be happy with the trade between 2,300 tons of nuclear waste and 30,000 tons of sulfur dioxide. And I would suggest that we should join the good people of the PG&E PR department in proclaiming that the future is wind, water, and sun, to which Sierra Club would add that the future is now. We agree with the previous speaker who said that we're here to help you, and we've been happy to help you by suing you to compel you to do your jobs. I was struck by your response that you have considered terrorism, but what the Ninth Circuit said was that you simply need to consider terrorism in your environmental review. And I'm fairly certain that what you actually did was refuse to consider that an attack on the dry gas storage facility was reasonably foreseeable, that the likelihood of a terrorist attack against a nuclear facility was remote and speculative, and that when your attorney made that argument at the hearing, the Ninth Circuit panel judge was notably skeptical of that argument, noted that the President of the United States did not seem to agree with that position, and the Ninth Circuit itself subsequently ruled against that. When you say that the NRC is weighing its response to the court's decision, I think the question has to be asked, why are you weighing your response to the court's decision? Because your response essentially has to be either yes or no, as in, yes, Your Honor, we will comply with the court's decision. We will conduct an environmental review that contains an evaluation of a possible terrorist attack on this facility, or no, we are going to challenge your decision to the Supreme Court. And if your answer was yes, I don't think we understand why you couldn't make that answer in the first 24 hours. And if your answer is no, or if you're actually taking time to consider what other response you might make other than compliance, and in that vacuum, allowing PG&E to go full speed ahead with a project that's unlikely to be unbuilt if your study finds that it's not in compliance, that you did an environmental review that found a terrorist attack is likely and it has to be redesigned, how is this fulfilling your role to make sure that the facility is designed and operated safely?
Yeah, I appreciate the comment. I believe we've answered that question at least two, maybe three times, so I'm not going to answer it again. But we do understand the question and the comment, so thank you.
All right, with that, I'd like to... conclude the meeting. Dr. Mallett would like to provide a few closing comments. But one comment from myself. I've been the branch chief of responsibility for Diablo Canyon for coming on 6 years now. And I personally appreciate the opportunities to talk with the members of the community. This started several years ago, and I think that the communications have improved tremendously. One of the factors in that has been you have provided us, community members, provided us feedback on how we can better communicate with you. And part of that is the feedback form you have available, or we have additional copies outside. I do encourage you to take a few moments to think about tonight's meeting and to provide us additional input on what we can do to continue to enhance. I understand that some of the questions that came up, we couldn't always provide.
Apologize. Was it Shirley or Susan? I'm sorry. We had to get back to her on the Price-Anderson Act. And then we had to get back to Jill on the schedule for the rulemaking on the DBT. So we do need to take those actions, and we'll take them with us. I would say that we are clearly successful in the dialogue with you. Again, there are issues on both sides of many of the topics we discussed tonight. But I think this is successful. To me, we had dialogue, and that's what we started out to do. So thanks again for your time. Anyone else want to say anything? Have a good night.